God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. For an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome Tim, who's on Into Action.
Into Action.
Into Action.
David. I'm recovered alcoholic right. named Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Okay, so we finished last week with chapter How It Works, the ominous, that being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Dun, 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 dun. And so with that,
that's good, right?
Yeah. Once again, the Tim disclaimer of this is my experience, strength, and hope with the book Alcoholics Anonymous, known as the Big Book. I do not speak for AA, though at times I sound like I do, and I continue to work on that on a daily basis. So, with that said, this is, to me, the chapter Into Action is probably the meatiest chapter in the book. It covers steps 5 through 11. I mean, that's a lot of work right there. So I'm going to do my best to try to keep them moving and hopefully get to the end of the chapter. If not, we'll just continue next week. So Into Action, it starts on page 72. Now, the first thing I'd like to say about that is for years I've always heard things like, you know, the chapter says, Into Action, not Into Thinking. You know, you hear that around the rooms. And I always say, you know, I think I've made it pretty clear that thinking is an action. It's probably one of the most important actions that we have, because everything that we do physically, or even our decisions through the step process, before we even put pen to paper, before we even get to the third step, before we get to the second step, before we even decide to do the steps, requires thought. So here we are, we're into action, you know, that launching pad from that ominous dun-dun-dun that we had, and it brings us in there. So now, he gets right into that, and he says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. Okay, so there's our purpose right there. A new attitude, because obviously our old one was awful, right? A new relationship with our Creator, because if you're anything like me, the relationship that you had with your Creator was tainted at best. And to discover the obstacles on our path. And once again, you know, that's obstacles in our path to getting to our closer to our higher power. There are no assets in our path to getting to our higher power, right? So he says, we have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which, when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. And then he gives us a hint here. He says, this brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. So, you know, it's important there. He reiterates what it is that we're about to do. And the importance of the process and the order in which we're doing the admission, the order, we're admitting to God first, and then we're admitting to ourselves, and then another human being. So without doing those two things within the process, admitting something to another human being, it's kind of falling short of the ideal, right? So then he gets into, you know, talking about the heaviness of this. He says, this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. And for me, like, I always identify with that, because no matter what goes on in my head, and even if I put it on paper and I go through a process and I say, what's my part, what's their part, all this stuff, I could kind of twist it to make it so, oh, well, it's really not as bad as that, you know. And so that's my solitary self-appraisal. And generally, when I talk to my sponsor or my spiritual guide or even just somebody within my network that I trust, to say, hey, let me tell you about what happened. Guess what they did to me? Or guess what she did to me? Or what he said to me? And do you believe this? And once I start talking about it, 9 times out of 10, the person I'm talking to is either smiling, or they're looking at me like, what's the matter with you? Or, you know, there's some sort of reaction that's being reflected back to me that there's obviously something wrong with my way of thinking, and that solitary self-appraisal that I had. So, you know, I find it, and then he says it right there, and he hangs it out. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. Again, we're thinking. We got to stop doing that, you know, that's dangerous. Right? So then he says, we will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. You know, like the typical thing. Well, why? What's give me a good reason? You know, like there's always that thing, right? The best reason first, and there's my favorite colon, right? If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And there he says it again. He uses that word, vital, necessary for life. We may not overcome drinking. Okay, time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Okay, so now when we look at this, we say, all right, well, time after time, and they say newcomers, and I always find, well, how long is it somebody a newcomer? You know, because I've seen it with people in double-digit sobriety, that they try to keep to themselves something, you know, facts about their lives. Facts, not opinions, not feelings. Facts about their life, and try to keep that, you know, that humbling experience of exposing it that, wow, I am a human being, and here's the problem, and let me get that out there. I have to admit it, because generally, if you're working any sort of program, you do a lot of the admitting to God and to yourself on a daily basis. You do a lot of that stuff anyway. But it's the admitting to another person is usually where the trip happens. And then it just starts to build up, because now you have this one thing, and now you have this other thing. And I know for me, having many years of recovery, it is a very humbling experience to have to talk about my defects and my shortcomings with another human being. Because generally what I get back is that judgment of, well, if I were as sober as long as you are, I wouldn't. And it's like, it becomes, well, why don't you get there first? And then we'll talk about that. So generally, for me, it's always like my sponsor has more time than I do. And for my reasoning is that he's experienced more years of sobriety than I have, living sober. So he could maybe look back at where I am and go, oh yeah, I remember that. Because I know for me, when I sponsor people, especially newcomers, I can go right back to where I was and say, oh yeah, boy, I don't envy how you feel. You know, and so I could understand that. Now, there were times when I had people with less time, and it ended up being this ego battle of like, I'm your sponsor. And it's like, well, I'm not talking to you about that. I'm talking to you about this problem that I have that I need to identify, I need to share with you. I don't need a rebuking. I need you to shut up and listen. You know, and a lot of times my sponsor's really good at that. Because a lot of times we don't talk about big book stuff. I mean, he's not a big book guy at all. He's definitely a God guy. And so right there, we already match. But he does relationships a lot better than I do. And I don't just mean with his wife, but with people in general. I've known this man 10 years, and I've never seen him angry. I've never seen him, like, out of joint, which is just... And he goes to AA meetings. So just that fact in and of itself, that he goes to AA meetings and doesn't get out of joint, is like, miraculous to me. So I want what he has. So a lot of times, because my defects are usually fear-based and they're self-centered, I go to him and I can talk about them, and he just kind of, like, listens. And then he'll tell me a story about his own life that seemingly has absolutely nothing to do with what I just said. And then, like, and I'll be looking at him like, what is wrong with you, man? And then, like, 2 minutes later, it clicks. Like, oh, that's what he's talking about. Because he doesn't have to beat me over the head with it. He just kind of tells a story about himself. And it's just, you know, me and all my intellect, I need this, you know. But he just tells this nice little anecdote and kind of, like, sends me on my way angry still. And then I get it. I'm like, oh, that's what I mean, you know. So to me, that's a really good sponsor for me. But humbling experience. Turn to easier methods. Easier methods. You know, like going out with her, or, you know, for women, going out with him, or finding someone else to, you know, and telling them your stuff. and a lot of times, what, you know, he says almost invariably they got drunk. Because usually if you tell them your stuff, it gets used in an argument later on, for certain. You know, I've experienced that. I don't know if anybody else has. You know, and then there's like the, you know, switching gears of like, okay, well, I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to do this, and my thoughts are obsessive, so I'm going to go do other obsessive things. Like go to the gym 4 hours a day, every day. Or go shopping. Or, you know, all these things that aren't about trying to get to that experience with a higher power and get rid of all those things that are blocking us, right? So then he goes on and he says, having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory, all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough humility, fearlessness, and honesty. In the sense, we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. Now, right there, he says it again. He goes back to what my belief is about the process of recovery and the process of the steps. Having persevered with the rest of the program, okay, so going on and doing, you know, like, okay, you know, doing five, you know, two-thirds of five, admitting to God and to themselves, and, you know, maybe a few things to other human beings. But then going on to do six, seven, you know, and the rest of the program, persevering with the rest of the program. But yet there's that always, that goes back to that first step, that reservation, that lurking notion that somewhere, somehow, comes up and trips somebody up. I've seen it time and time again. Time and time again. Because if they turn to easier methods, obviously they're looking for an easier, softer way, and that's a reservation, because we have to be thorough, right? So, and even challenges that. They only thought they lost their egoism and fear and humbled themselves. But not enough. Not enough humility, not enough fearlessness, not enough honesty. And then he says here, until they told someone else all their life story. Now, that's really important. It says they told someone else all their life story. It doesn't say they wrote their life story. It drives me crazy when I hear people sitting down and writing their autobiographies for their fourth step to share with their sponsor because their sponsor instructed them and demanded them. It's like, it doesn't say that. They told someone else all their life story. Now, my experience is that when I go through the process of hearing somebody's fifth step, we go through the process of the resentments and the fears and the harms and the sex harms and their part and looking at it from all these different angles and being able to identify things. And then I start to ask questions. Was there anything you left out and you didn't tell me? Is there anything that you would never tell anybody? Those types of things, little things. And then I start to ask questions. Well, did anything ever happen in your childhood with family members? Did anything ever happen in school? Did anything ever happen? Because I could see within the resentments and the fears and the harms somebody's life. If they've done it thoroughly. If they went back through their life. And I could see it and they lay it out. So it's really a trusting thing that they're doing. So for me, I'm responsible to try to pull as much out of somebody so they can be free of it. Because that's the whole point of this. We swallowed some huge chunks of truth. And that truth is just, oh, it's awful. And it's in there. It's making me sick. And I got to get that out. So I'm trying to get them to purge all that stuff. So that's the process that I go through with people. And it's pretty cool. And he says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He's very much the actor. To the other world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside of himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. That makes for more drinking. Now, I've seen experience and talked to other people who have experienced in recovery that type of living. And most often it usually has to do with either the checkout line or driving. You know what I mean? Like, we're these paragons of serenity most of the time, and then put a steering wheel in our hand. I just went through it. I mean, I'm like, I'm like yelling, come on, Flintstone, you know what I mean? Like, because I'm forgetting, like, oh, I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, and then I get to a store, and maybe I didn't leave enough time for myself. So now I'm at a store, and I'm hurried, and I'm tense, and somebody's got 8 million coupons, and then now they want to write a check. And I'm like, come on, let's go, you know. And then all of a sudden, there may be somebody from AA that sees me just all twisted up in a pretzel. And they go, see, yeah, we knew he's full of crap. You know. So it's, and that's in recovery. So, I remember in my drinking days, oh my God, you know, I just thought I was the greatest guy in the world, and I was like, good time, Charlie. Good time, Charlie. Till about one. So about 1 o'clock, and then, you know, then it was like the gargoyle off the church is what happened, you know, and a lot of times I would like, you know, I didn't think I was a blackout drinker until other people told me stories about myself that I didn't remember. I'm like, that's bullshit, you know, like, and then they tell me, and I'm like, wow, did that really happen? Like a perfect example, I stayed over at a friend's house because I was homeless at the time, and the guy comes out and he agrees, so he says, listen, three things. You can have something to drink if you want. Help yourself. He said, but don't eat anything, and don't talk on the phone. Oh, okay, no problem. Right? Apparently, a half hour later, he came out of his bedroom, and I'm on the phone with a sandwich. You know what I mean? Like, that's, and I didn't remember it, because that was the type of person I was. And then, like, I stuffed that way inside of myself, hoping it wouldn't see the light of day. Because, well, you know, everybody screws up, whatever, you know, and fluffing it up. But meanwhile, those were the types of things, those little things piled on, one on top of each other, were the kind of things that were killing me and making me drink more. Because now I felt bad about myself because it really wasn't the guy who I thought I was, and just trying to keep up that persona all the time. Just trying to be that actor all the time. It's just, it's exhausting. It's exhausting to do that. So I definitely understand that. Okay, so then he says, psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We've spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we have given these doctors a fair break. We've seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance of recovery. I mean, here are people who are, we are paying to tell our life to keep it a secret, to be quiet about it, and we don't tell them the truth. And then we ask them for help, and they tell us to do, okay, well, perhaps you shouldn't date that person anymore. No, that's not it, you know. And we go on and do what we want to do anyway. And so they go, oh, these drunks, man. You know? And I can understand that, certainly, right? Well, we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long, happily, or happily in this world. Now, he doesn't say if we expect to stay sober or live sober. He says to live long or happily. Okay, so again, it's about living. It's not really about the drinking. That's the secondary part of it. That's cool. Okay, now he says, rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Okay, and naturally, that's our natural thing for us to do, is to think well. And it's correct, he says, to think well. And once again, how many times do we hear?
No, I don't think just to tell him. Just do what you're told.
Well, no, I'm about to, like, share my entire life with somebody, which is intimate. It's an intimate thing, and I need to be, you know, keep a confidence that this person's going to shut up. Then I'm not going to tell, like, if I go, hey, Dave, I need to talk to you about something, and I go and I talk to him, and I should be able to tell him whatever, and I know that's just going to stay with David. I need to have that, and I need to think rightly, and it's natural to have an apprehension to make sure that I can trust that person. And that's what he says, so... Okay, and then he drops the religion thing in there, and those of us belonging to a religious denomination, which requires confession a must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with somebody ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. So, like... for me, that was a boon for me, because I grew up Catholic, I understood the practice of it, I understood the practice of confession. There was a priest that I knew that I trusted in my teens, and I went to him with the stuff that I knew that could get me in trouble. How's that? That's the best way. Could get me in trouble with places I didn't want to get in trouble. And I knew he would have to keep his mouth shut. And I explained it to him, and he got it. He knew. He wasn't an alcoholic. He wasn't in AA, but he certainly understood what we were driving at. And then I've met other people, ordained people, who tried to pull away from the process of the step work. That it becomes, okay, well, no, you don't need that. You need this dogmatic approach of this particular faith. Which is great for them. Okay, but for me, it goes against that. You know, that's the person who doesn't understand that I need this process. And although that process may be great, I still need this process in order to supplement or that supplement this process. I need that, right? Okay, and then he says, if we cannot or would not rather do this, we search our acquaintance for a closed-mouthed, understanding friend. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. It may be one of our own family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or parents which will hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we tell to someone who will understand, yet be unaffected. Okay? Now, before I read that last sentence, that's important for me to address. Like, I've never been a fan of, my wife's my sponsor. My husband's my sponsor. My father, my mother, they're my sponsor. I've never been a fan of that. And I'll tell you why. Those of you who've been here from the beginning, you know, you've heard me talk about my father having been in AA before I was and having that relationship. And there were times that he would use what I would say in meetings in an argument at home about, like, maybe the garbage or something. You know, like, so there was never, you know, it was like, okay, wait a minute. There had to be lines established. Okay, you can't talk to me as another alcoholic if you're going to talk to me as my father. And those rules had to be established. So it became paramount that I had a sponsor that wasn't him, and that he didn't talk to my sponsor, and my sponsor was well aware not to talk to my father, and would tell him so. Because my father did things like, you know, I wish you would talk to my son about this. And my sponsor would say things like, well, I wish you would talk to your son about that. You know, and that's how he handled it. So that was important. And he said, you know, no right to save our own skin at another's expense. So within that relationship, especially spousal, you know, if there are things that are happening that there may have been some misgivings that affect the emotional well-being of the other person, that person shouldn't be the one hearing it. You know, that's just not really fair. Because, oh, I may feel great after having got that off my chest. But now what about that person? What about the person who I say that I love? Okay, well, that's not very loving if I'm dumping all this stuff so I feel better on them. And now they're walking around with their own life, plus my burden that I just handed them. So I've never been a big fan of that stuff. So, next sentence. It says that we've heard... I know I've heard 1,000 times, if I've heard it once. There are no rules in AA. The next sentence says, the rule is, we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. It's a rule. There it is. It's a rule. You know, besides the steps. But that one's quite specific. Hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. And I don't know about anybody else, but there's so many times that... my tongue bleeds from biting it so hard, so I'm considerate of others. Because I just want to tell them about something, or I may want to, or I want to purge that resentment that I have, you know, because I'm not really willing. I'm not willing to make amends. I'm, like, dying to make amends. You know what I mean? There's a big difference. Like, so I'm, like, ready to jump on them. So that's not a good thing for me. So I have to be considerate. And that's like one of the questions that I always pass on to people. There's two ways that I try to put my thinking. For my thoughts, because if they're about me, I know they're wrong, unless it's to help someone else or to better my life to help other people, because that's important to me. But if it's about someone else or something that I'm going to do or planning to do is affecting somebody else's life, the question I ask myself is this selfish? Okay, and then so then right there, a lot of times I can't get past that question. Because it's usually, yeah, it is, can't do that, you know. Or the fortunate times when I'm able to get past, oh, no, it's not selfish. Well, the next question I have to ask before I take the action is my actions, is it considerate? Has it been thoughtful about how it's going to affect that other person? Okay, so that goes back to this right here, because that's a rule. It's a rule. That's one of the rules of AA. I need to be hard on myself and always considerate of others. So that's important for me. So I always pound that into other people and myself, because that's how it works for me, right? Okay, so then he says, notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one is so situated that there is no suitable person available.
If that is so, this step may be postponed only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious that we talk to the right person. It is important that he be able to keep a confidence, that he fully understand and approve what we are driving at, that he will not try to change our plan. But we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. Okay, so obviously when Bill wrote this, it was different back then. You know, there wasn't as many people in recovery, certainly. So, there wasn't that availability that we could go to a meeting and find somebody that may have some years of experience with recovery in the book and be able to find somebody that we could trust and gain a confidence with and be intimate and do that. So a lot of times this doesn't necessarily apply today. However, I have a friend who was in prison for 2 years. So you're certainly not going to find somebody in prison that you want to do a fifth step with. Absolutely not, because they may get like a shorter bid, based on your fifth step. You know what I mean? So that's pretty important right there. You know, you always think like, oh, well, why would you postpone it? And then you meet somebody and say, oh, that's why I would. So it's really cool how those kind of things keep happening in my life. Now, where it says fully understand and approve what we're driving at. You know, to me it's important that somebody has experience with the book, that they've experienced the fifth step for themselves, that they've experienced hearing a fifth step, so they fully understand and approve what they're driving at. Because so many times I've heard people say, you know, somebody goes through the trouble and the great necessity and work of doing that fourth step and getting all that garbage out onto paper and taking all that time and feeling really good about it and getting together with that person to do a fifth step, and then it's ignored. We're not even going to look at them. I mean, I can't tell you how many times. Oh, well, did you do a fifth step with your sponsor? Oh, yeah, we got together. Well, what did they say about your fears? Oh, we didn't even look at that. What do you mean you didn't look at that? You wrote it down. Yeah, we just kind of talked about this and that. Well, what did you talk about? How long were you there? You know, so to me, that's somebody that doesn't understand nor approve what you're trying to do. They're trying to do it their way. No, we don't need to do that. We'll just have a talk. We'll chat. We'll have a coffee. What do you want? You want a bagel? You know, like, that's not the fifth step. The fifth step is, like, going through somebody's life with them, right? And that's changing somebody's plan. I've seen that all the time. Oh, we're not going to do it that way. Well, but wait a minute. You know, like, this is a perfect example. Somebody who comes through a big book workshop, and they get inventory papers, and they get a prompt sheet, and they get resentment paper and a fear paper and a harms paper and all the stuff that to do their fourth step. And then they go home to their sponsor and they say, look at all this great stuff I got. And he said we could do this and this in the book. And we're not going to do it that way. Well, then why'd you send me to the workshop? Well, so you could hear something. You know, like a lot of that, I've experienced that so many times of people going to a big book workshop, especially the ones now, I'm really like laid back about it, but there's ones that are like, you need to have a step sponsor with you at the workshop. Because you're going through the steps in the workshop. So, why would you go to a workshop to do steps and not do them? Or have a sponsor that tells you, well, don't do them that way. You know, like, that just makes no sense to me. So, okay, now, here's some more instructions. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. So we get right to it, right? We have a written inventory, a written one. And we are prepared for a long talk. In my case, it's usually at least a day. I usually set it up with people I sponsor on like a Saturday or a Sunday. And hopefully we get through the entire fifth step in the process within that day. Sometimes it's two. Sometimes it may be like the following week or whatever, or remnants throughout the week. But to me, I don't think that's unreasonable. You know, it's a process of saving your own life. So you can give up a day of shopping on Saturday or give up a day of football on Sunday, whatever it may be, to save your own life. You know, I'm giving up my time gladly to help you with that, you know, because that's how I look at it, right? Then he says, we explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. So that's cool. Like, I already know that, so I don't have to do that when people come to me. He should realize we are engaged in a life and death errand. And I say that all the time. It's not about just quitting drinking. This is life and death. If we don't do this, we're going to die. It's not like, ooh, boogeyman.
I've watched it happen. People don't do it, and they die. They die. Because it's about alcohol, and it's cunning, baffling, powerful, patient, and jealous, right? Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence, because I certainly am. I always feel like I'm a vault. That's how I look at it. I tell people things, you know, because in my life I have to be careful of certain things. So there's, I say there's two things you can't tell me. You can't tell me if you've murdered somebody or if you're going to. And you can't tell me those things because I have to do something about that. I said, other than that, you can tell me whatever. And it's going to stay with me. And nobody will ever hear it from my mouth. Ever. I know, oh my God, I know so much about so many people. And it's amazing. Like, and I'm true to that because it's a life and death error. Because the things that people tell me, if I turn around and I tell somebody else, that could kill them too. Because then what happens? They have this confidence in me. They were intimate with me. They trusted their life with me. And I went and treated it like it was gossip or it was fodder for a soap opera. And now it comes around to them, and oh my God, I can't do this, and hey, look what AA did, I came in and I told my sponsor this, and this happened, and it became this whole thing about a meeting, and now this whole meeting happened. And that happens a lot in men's meetings and women's meetings especially. Happens constantly. Because people forget that meetings are not a fifth step. You know, you can't just come to a meeting and say anything that you want in a meeting, and it'll stay there. That's not true. It's a falsity. It's a falsehood. Okay, it'd be nice if that were the case, but unfortunately, we're just, you know, we're human beings, and some days, sometimes, like, people say things, and they pass things on that they shouldn't pass on, or, you know, well-intended, like, oh, I was just trying to help them, and they shared something, so I told somebody else that it was going to affect, and whoa. Okay, so when it comes to meetings, you know, and I hear this a lot in beginner meetings, and it scares me. You know, they say, you know, whatever you say here, we'll stay here. I'm like, don't. You know, my hand goes, I mean, I jump out of my chair when that happens. I'm like, don't tell people that. That's not true. You know, like, what can be shared at a meeting is stuff in a general way about how we're dealing with particular problems and how God's helping us to solve them. I mean, that's really what it should be about. You know, it's not this, oh, I had this problem in my relationship, and, oh, I'm cheating on my husband, oh, I'm cheating on my wife, and, oh, don't be saying that kind of stuff in a room. You know, and certainly don't be sitting in a room saying you were going over to your girlfriend's house who has a restraining order on you. You can't do that kind of stuff because you never know who's an officer of the law. And they're bound to their job before they're bound to an AA meeting. That's just how it works. But people think, oh, well, you're just trying to be... I'm like, okay, well, I'll come and visit you in the county when you do it. You know, so that's why it's important that it's intimate. This process of doing the fifth step is intimate and we need to have a confidence in that person. That's so I beat that to death all the time, right? Okay, here we go. Fifth step promise is coming. It's wonderful. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Right, that's huge. Right, and here's the promises. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We're delighted. That's wonderful. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone and at perfect peace and ease. Here's a big one. I love this. Our fears fall from us. Not even like, you know, it's just like that. I always imagine like fears just kind of being clung all over me like jellyfish. And like I like do a fifth step and then just kind of fall off. Like that's really cool. I love that. That's one of my favorites. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. Now, I must say, when I did this for the first time and went through that process, because I told, you know, some closed-mouthed friends, I told my sponsor some things because I don't know about anybody else, but I had trust issues when I got here, right? And like I told you, I told my priest some stuff. But I purged all myself. So a lot of this stuff did happen. However, the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared did not happen right away. That took about 18 months for that to happen. For one day, for me to go through one day of me not thinking about drinking. But that gave me hope, that one day. Because I remember thinking, oh my God, I didn't think about drinking yesterday. And I was like, it worked! And then I thought about drinking. You know, but I just that mustard seed of faith and hope, and it just expanded from there. And I was able to really say, oh wow, look at that, it really does work. Okay, so now instructions. Now I have to say that we're about to go into the sixth and seventh step. Now when I do this process, now he says here, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. Okay, now for me, my experience has been, after having done a fifth step and that feeling that people get when they purge their life and they're feeling wonderful, if I send them home for an hour, they're not going to do the sixth step, and they don't do the seventh step, and they don't go on, and I'm going, hey, when are we getting together to do that eighth step, and when are we going to do the, oh, I'm kind of busy, and you know, and it stops, and it stalls. Okay, so I always keep them with me. Now, when I say I keep them with me, what I do is, I usually set up, I say, well, you know, where do you feel most spiritual? You know, some people say, oh, there's this place up in the mountains I like, or, you know, down the shore, or over here at this particular church, or someplace here. I said, okay, cool. So what I end up doing is, you know, we'll go through that process and get it at, and then we go to that place with their fourth step, with them, they have it. And then they spend that hour with their fourth step, talking to God, reviewing what they've done, right? And then he says, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. That's wonderful. That's a prayer right there. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we omitted anything. For we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Remember that arch we talked about, right? Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Our cornerstones, our keystones, step two, step three. Have we skimped on the cement, put in the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Have we done that first step thoroughly? Right? Page 76, he says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all? Every one. If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us to be willing. So there's more prayers in there, right? Now, for me, before taking that hour and looking at those proposals and getting into that meditative state of looking at this, I always ask this question. Because, you know, if you did the fourth step the way we've been going through it and looking at it, you have lots of papers. You have just papers of your life right here. And I usually say, okay, well, what do you want to keep? What of this do you want to keep? And people are usually like, nothing. I don't want to keep any of this. So that's usually that willingness there is right there. And to me, that's one of the key ingredients as to why it's important for them to stay with me. Because if they go home and they're not looking at it from that perspective, they're just kind of, you know, they stack their papers up and maybe put it back in a binder and put it up on the shelf or something, and that's the end of it, and they're not looking at it. Whereas if it's there, the mess of their life is right in front of them. Well, what do you want to keep? Because I didn't want to keep anything. But stuff still falls back on me because obviously I'm clinging to something. Because it says that I cling to it. Well, I want to get rid of anything except this. Kind of reminds me of, what was that, The Jerk, right, with Steve Martin? He said, I don't need anything except this. But that's all I need. And he keeps grabbing things as he's walking out of the house. Well, that's all I need, this remote and this thing. Right? And then the joke, he trades it all for a thermos, you know. Right. So for me, it's important that they see it from that point. Now, which we admit are objectionable, right? So we don't keep assets. You know what I mean? We don't object to assets. Assets are there. They're always saying, oh, I want to get rid of being a nice guy. I want to get rid of being considerate. I want to get rid of being punctual. Like, you know, so like that stuff doesn't belong on an inventory that we're trying to get rid of crap, you know? So it's there. All, everyone. So that's pretty important. So we're there, and willingness. You know, I talk about that all the time. You know, eager compliance, a cheerful choice. Are we happy to get rid of them? Yeah, I want to get rid of it, you know. Now, the important part for me in the fifth step process, identifying for the person the nature of their defect. Okay. Now we talked about that a little bit in how it works on page 62. Where, you know, remember my stealth car that I always talk about? That selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of our trouble. So there's the root, and then there's four natures of that. Okay. There's fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. So those six things are the natures of my defects. So within that process, I mean, obviously we have an entire list of one nature. The fear inventory is an entire list of that. But everything else, it's really important to start to point out, well, here's self-delusion. And here's fear, and here's self-pity, and here's selfishness, and here's self-centeredness. And that's really important for me to point out, to make the person well acquainted with the nature of it. So if it pops up in their life again, they go, they can recognize, oh, I'm in my self car again. You know, so that's an important part of the process. Then he says, when we're ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. Okay, so in 3 paragraphs, we did 6 and 7. 3 paragraphs. That's it. It's all it takes up. Bottom of 75, top of 76, those 2 paragraphs. So, wow, look at that. Now we're at step 8 already. Oh, my God, this is really cool. Now we're moving along, and we're talking, and I'm feeling good. Hey, I'm definitely past halfway point. I got past 6, oh, 7, 8. Oh, I'm at 8. Right? That's really cool. So now here we are, and he says, now we need more action, without which we find faith without works is dead. Which, by the way, was Ann Smith's favorite quote from the Bible. That was in James, is where that comes from, you know, just to be a little controversial. But she loved that. So that's why it appears, I think, 3 times in the book. It says, now let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed to who we are willing to make amends. Notice he said we have one, right? Well, how do we have one? We made it when we took inventory. Well, how convenient. That's excellent. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. That was what we just did, right? Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. So we pray until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any length for victory over alcohol. Remember at the beginning, we agreed to get rid of reservations and lurking notions. Wow, look at that. It went right back to step 1 again on us. Tell him I'll call him back. Right? So then he says, probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not, and probably should not, emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Remember, it goes back to that rule of we're hard on ourselves and easy on, considerate of others, right? This I love. This is very subtle. Right? He says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to the people about us. Right there. That's our real purpose. So when it comes down to it, I, as a recovered alcoholic, have a real purpose of fitting myself to be of maximum service to God and those about me. So if nothing else, that's what I have to do with my life. That's what I have to do. So everything in my life needs to kind of be a vortex of sucking into that particular purpose, because that's my real purpose. You know, what I do in my career, what I do in my relationships, what I do out in the world, what I do working, what I do on this planet for the rest of my life needs to be to try to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and those about me. And that's a very subtle thing, man. It's a subtle thing that he just kind of, oh, by the way, drops in there. Right in the middle of telling people to, well, you don't need to go and talk to people about God right away. You know, like, I remember when I got sober, you know, that feeling that I've heard other people experience of, like, I want to go and say I'm sorry to everybody. I want to tell them, hey, man, I got God. I'm sober. Well, how long are you sober? Like 3 months, man. Whoa. Hey, slow down, cowboy. You know, and you should just, oh, what are you talking about? You told me I got to go and do this stuff. I got to clean up the past. It's like, well, you know, like the past isn't that long ago. You know, like, chill. Okay, I guess. Because that's what I wanted to do. I was just so relieved to find out that I really was the nice guy. I really was the person who I thought I was. But there was all this stuff, layers and layers of crap that were on me that just got stripped away. that got stripped away, and I felt lighter, and I wanted to go out into the world, and I wanted to share that with everyone. So it was really important. And remember, I got sober young, too. So all my contemporaries, you know, and they were theater people, too, on top of it. So that was just... So now, here's the big drunk that comes back to the theater world and is no longer drinking and no longer doing mood and mind-altering substances and is talking differently and is being considerate and not being the person he was. And people are like, what's up with you? It's like, oh, nothing, man. You know, and people would push. They would push. But no, what's going on? This isn't you. This isn't the Tim we know. I say, but this is the Tim you should know and get used to. You know, and it became this thing of, like, people would push and push and push and push. And we get to the point where, as we've read before in the book, I would talk about God. Well, God's got me.
Oh, now it's about God. Yeah, oh, last year you were this and that, and it was that and this. And oh, now it's God.
Okay, so he's kind of like warning us about that. Okay, so he says, it is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that you have gone religious. In the prize ring, that would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. But our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He's going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talking of spiritual discoveries. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense, which I had none of. I did not have common sense, and I certainly did not have tact. I was known for not having tact. I was as subtle as a meat hook, is what they used to say. Right? The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Now, this is still difficult for me. Okay, because that statement where it says they may have done more harm to you than you have to them. And despite that feeling, despite that fact, if I'm allowing them to have that kind of power in my life, if I'm allowing myself to have a resentment toward them, because anytime I have resentment, remember we talked about that, big pile of self, on top of it is resentment, and the resentment is all about me. So now I hate this guy. Oh, I can't hate them. What do you mean I can't hate them? He kicked my dog, you know, like that kind of stuff. Like, so now it becomes, I have to put the bit in my teeth and bite down on it. And really go in that forgiving spirit of, I'm like, you know, listen, I really have to apologize to you for, you know, like reacting the way I did. I mean, there was a guy who literally, in a meeting, this is wonderful, in a meeting, in an AA meeting, who took exception to me identifying myself as a recovered alcoholic, right, and wanted to know why. So I started to tell him why, and 4 words into my sentence, he interrupted me. And I said, oh, well, you just really don't want to know why. You just want to talk and argue. I said, well, I'm done. Oh, no, now I'm really going to bother you. So that's what he said. We're in an AA meeting. Right? So I'm walking away, and he's poking at me. And finally I said, quite incorrectly and wrongly, if you don't get away from me, I'm going to put you through the wall. Okay? That's what I said. Which was wrong, obviously. Because I allowed my pride and my fear and my anger, I allowed him to win, right? So he leans across the table at me, like in the middle of the two tables, and parts the tables and gets this close to my face, and he says, what are you going to do about it? And goes like this. Now, let me tell you, if I hadn't done these steps, and I hadn't had a spiritual experience as the result of them, there might have been a different outcome. But I was able to feel God come in me at that time. Now, I you know, it sounds all hokey, okay, but that's the truth. Because I was able to pause, and I was able to take a deep breath, and I was able to say, like we learned in the fourth step, this is a sick man. God save me from being angry. How can I help him? Okay? Because I certainly wouldn't have helped him if I put him through the table. And I certainly wouldn't have helped me. And it wouldn't have been of maximum service to him or anybody else. Okay? So I was able to step back and I was able to say, you know what? I'm not engaging anymore. And I walked away. And that was on a Thursday, and I got to see this person on a Sunday. And I walked up to him immediately. I said, listen, I want to apologize for the way I reacted. I said, whatever you said doesn't matter. I said, but it was inappropriate how I responded to you, and I want to apologize for that, and I hope you can forgive me. Okay, and immediately he said, yeah, no, I have a problem with that confrontation thing. I'm sorry about that myself and all. Okay, and immediately it like went away. It was dissolved. And now the guy talks to me. And now he asks me questions about recovery. Could you imagine that? Like that's the power of God. That's the power of these steps. That's the power of this process. So by taking this process, what seems like an impossibility on the piece of paper, and putting it in my life, making it real, because then the next thing he says, right? He says, under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply tell them that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. Now, I didn't need to do that. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. Never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, open, we will be gratified with the result. Okay, that was a real happening. That was exactly what happened. I was calm, I was frank, I was open. Well, actually, I was Tim. Sorry, that was a bad one. Had to do it, right? And I was certainly gratified. I was gratified with the result, because here's what happened. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault. So feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally, they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. Okay, so that was a real happening in my life. Black and white became reality. And that's, like, these are true words. They do happen. It doesn't happen automatically. I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, and I always talk about this, about the pause, you know, when doubtful or agitated, because I was certainly agitated and quite doubtful at the time, we paused. And I heard this in a meeting, and this is something, one of the gems that I've taken and stolen and pass on, that for every year I stay sober, I get a second of pause. Okay? So he got 19 seconds when that happened. Well, actually 18 when that happened. He had 18 seconds of my pause. and so that was really cool. Because that enabled my higher power to come in and take over and do for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because what I wanted to do, I told you what I wanted to do. I told him what I wanted to do. So it's the process works. It really works, right? Now it gets into some other means of making amends. Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Yeah. Telling them what we are trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory that it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear. We must lose our fear of creditors, no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Now, I'm guessing things were a lot different when this was written. I know for me, my personal finance credit stuff, you know, I still have the fears of having to deal with them sometimes because they're just vultures, you know. But here's the thing. It's not my money. It's their money. It's their money. I owe them money. I made a deal with them, and I owe them money, and they want their money. And how dare they ask me for their money, right? So I need to, you know, I don't need to tell them about my drinking or that stuff because they're not a personal to me. If somebody, you know, that I knew when I was drinking and I owed them money, because that happened, I owed them money. I was like, you know, sorry, man, I was a drunk and, you know, listen, I can give you like $50 now and like, you know, and I did those kind of things. But now, you know, life circumstances happened, and I created debt for myself. So I had to take care of it. And I did it in the best way that I knew how. And I talked to people who had experience with it, and I was able to say things like, well, listen, you know, I know I owe you a lot of money, but I can afford to pay you like $10 a month.
And then, oh, no, no.
So, okay, well, listen, I just offered you $10 a month. So you either take the $10 a month or stop calling me. Because that's my right, you know, as a credit consumer. So I offer them a deal, and they have to take my deal. And a lot of times they push and push and push. And I said, well, listen, you know, I realized that just looking at my finances, you know, I can really only afford a dollar a month. And usually they'll say something like, oh, so $10 a month you can afford? Right? Because it's not about, like, me not trying to pay them, because I am. I have a limited income. I need to eat. And I need to exist. I need to be of maximum service to God and those about me. And if I can't do that on a basic level, what good am I, right? So I'm not trying to duck my responsibilities financially, but I have to do it in a way that is feasible, okay? So for me, that's my experience with it. Okay, and then he goes on to talk about crime. Right? He says, perhaps we've committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in confidence to another person, but we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense cap. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried, but haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She is indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble, too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. So that's a prayer. We ask God. That's who we're asking. We're not asking somebody else. We're asking God. We pray. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. Okay, and sometimes that's the truth. But obviously that's up to the individual and their higher power, and I think calm, level-headed, reasonable people. Now, I've heard experiences of people who get sober, and they get involved with these groups of people who are like, no, this is what, oh, you drank at that job? Well, you can't work there anymore. You know, and somebody will be sitting and they'll get a call. A lot of times this happens like in the construction field. And they'll get a call from somebody that they used to work with, but they drank a lot with them. And you can't go to work for them. It's like, well, what, are you going to pay my electric bill? Are you going to pay my mortgage? I have to go to work. Oh, no, God will provide. Well, God just did provide. He provided a job. The problem isn't the job. The problem is me. Okay, so we avoid hysterical thinking and advice is generally what it comes down to. So he gets into to more things. We're going to stop here this week because it's important to be thorough about this. So the biggest thing to remember about the process so far is that the fifth step needs to be with somebody that we feel comfortable with and confident with, that we trust. And that sixth and seventh step need to be done immediately following, within the hour after the fifth step, because that's the instructions in the book, for an hour. We go home for an hour and we do it. And then the eighth step, you know, that's what's important about doing the thorough fourth step, because it tells us if we do that, we already have an eight-step list from our fourth step. So we don't have to write it again. You know, we already have it. So what? All this writing, you know, you hear me talk about, oh, well, I'm writing on this, I'm writing on this. What are you writing on? Fourth step, that's it. That's all we've written so far, the fourth step. So, and it's cool because we're kind of cheating. You know, we can do an eighth step when we do the fourth step. I like that. You know, that's part of my character defect. I like cheating a little bit. So I hope I helped somebody, and that's all I have this week. Thank you.